level of Maslow's hierarchy can be threatened by having untrustworthy people in the group, even children. After a walker bite kills Lizzie and Mika's father, Carol assumes a parental role for the two girls. Throughout her time in the prison, Lizzie displays an unusual and unhealthy relationship with the walkers. She treats them very much as if they were still human, even giving them names at the prison fences. More problems with Lizzie emerge after the prison falls in the governor's second attack. Led by Tyrese, Lizzie escapes with Mika and Rick's baby daughter, Judith. During one evening stop, Lizzie kills baby bunnies. Lizzie's antisocial actions become even more pronounced over time. When Tyrese leaves the children alone, Lizzie attempts to smother baby Judith. Though this begins as an act of protection, trying to keep her silent, Lizzie becomes hyper-focused on suffocating Judith before Carol interrupts her. This is the first real sign that Lizzie threatens the safety of others in the group. After Carol rejoins them, Lizzie shows more problems recognizing the walkers as dangerous. She plays tag with one, calling it her friend. She loses the ability to perceive the distinction between walkers and living people. Eventually, she returns to a walker trapped in the railroad tracks that she passed earlier. She feeds the walker a mouse. When her sister Mika catches her, Lizzie tells her, "They just want me to change, to make me be like them," as she moves her hand toward the walker's mouth. It takes a violent act before Carol and Tyrese see what they might do. After the two adults return from a walk, they find Lizzie holding a knife covered in blood. She is standing in front of Mika's body. She insists that she didn't kill Mika, since she didn't hurt her brain, and that she was just about to help baby Judith change, too. Tyrese learns that Lizzie had been feeding walkers at the prison and had mutilated a rat and nailed it to a board when they were there just having fun. They both realize that she can't be trusted around other people. And since she cannot survive on her own because of her youth and her mental illness, they decide that she has to be killed. It is a heartbreaking event for Carol and Tyrese, and one of the saddest moments in The Walking Dead. Lizzie's story is based on the comic book account of Ben, who similarly kills his own brother, Billy, although it's another youngster, Carl, who then kills Ben, even as Ben's adoptive father, Dale, argues against killing the killer child. It is hard to recognize that a child can be a threat to the safety of a group. It is even harder to make the decision that the child must be removed from the group, one way or another, if everyone else is to remain safe. The moment is shocking to us because we live in a world where any threats to our safety from a boy like Ben or a girl like Lizzie do not require such drastic and final measures. Maslow's hierarchy says we need safety, but we can protect ourselves from dangerous people in many ways. There are institutional checks on this behavior that probably would have detected it earlier, and there is support from medical professionals, mental health facilities, and even prisons. With no safety protection available from anywhere else, the survivors on The Walking Dead have to protect themselves. It is the only way to preserve that level of Maslow's hierarchy. When their safety is threatened, as it truly is by Lizzie, they sometimes make hard and harsh decisions to keep people alive. A personality analysis of two leaders and a follower. The Big Five personality factors are five facets of human personality, five sets of characteristics observed in people throughout the world, across cultures and generations. Openness. A person who is willing to try new things, have new experiences, and consider new ideas is open. Conscientiousness. People who are organized, are attentive to deadlines, and work to meet or exceed others' expectations are strong on this trait. Extroversion. When you feel energized after spending time interacting with others, you are an extrovert. Those who need time alone to re-energize are introverts. Agreeableness. Those who are kind, forgiving, and helpful, and who promote social harmony score high on agreeableness. People who are argumentative or rude score low. neuroticism. Emotional stability is the key to this personality trait. Angry, nervous people are strong neurotics. Laid-back, relaxed people are not. Personality affects the way we interact with others, how we react to situations, and how we are personally fulfilled. In the extreme conditions of the zombie apocalypse, people's true personality traits are likely to shine through. That's the case both when the higher levels of Maslow's hierarchy are removed, and people are fighting for food, water, and security, and in times of relative safety, when people focus on love, relationships, and esteem. Using a standard 44-question Big Five test, we analyzed the personalities of three important characters from The Walking Dead: Rick, the governor, and a walker. Case 1, Rick. Openness, very low. Conscientiousness, high. Extroversion, middle. Agreeableness, low middle. Neuroticism, high. Rick's openness score is low because he is down to earth and conservative in his choices. Circumstances force him into many new experiences, but he values stability. He is highly conscientious. He makes plans and works hard to carry them out effectively and efficiently. His agreeableness is low to medium. Because there is so much lawlessness in the post-apocalyptic world, Rick must engage in many conflicts. However, within his own group, he is supportive and forgiving, and he tries to create peace. The zombie apocalypse would make many people neurotic, and Rick is no exception. When the safety element of Maslow's hierarchy is missing, anxiety is a natural response to the nearly constant danger that people face. Case 2. The governor. Openness, middle. Conscientiousness, middle, high. Extroversion, very high. Agreeableness, low. Neuroticism, very high. Like Rick, the governor has high neuroticism. He is full of anxiety, to the point of paranoia, though he tends to focus on threats to his power more than on threats to his life and well-being. He is a strong extrovert, yet scores very low on agreeableness. Although he wants to maintain a peaceful atmosphere in Woodbury, he will create conflict with others over the smallest perceived slight. His conscientious score is middle-high. He will carry out his plans to their completion, but he can also be distracted in the middle of them. His openness falls roughly in the middle of the scale. The governor tends to run Woodbury conservatively, but he likes to experiment with new types of entertainment and artistic pursuits that reflect some openness. Case 3. A walker. Openness, very low. Conscientiousness, low. Extroversion, low middle. Agreeableness, very, very low. Neuroticism, low. Walkers are single-minded. They're not interested in, say, trying a vegetarian diet for a week. Openness. They do not make plans or care how others perceive them. Conscientiousness. Or try to promote social harmony. Agreeableness. They aren't big talkers, but are not especially shy or reserved either. Extroversion. They don't worry about their success or failures. Although they may get worked up in the moment, their anxiety is low. Neuroticism. Critical choices. Maslow's hierarchy of needs lays out the levels of human motivation from basic physiological survival to self-actualization. The zombie apocalypse destroys the safety level that so many of us take for granted, not only because zombies roam the earth, bent on killing and eating any humans they encounter, but also because law enforcement, government, and other institutions that ensure safety have disappeared. Consequently, it's other humans who pose the most complex and serious threat to one's safety. The Walking Dead is full of examples of this, from roving gangs that rape, assault, and kill others they find, to charismatic, violent, unstable leaders such as the governor, to mentally ill, murderous children such as Lizzie. Knowing who to trust with your safety is one of the most critical choices a survivor can make. If it's not the right decision, the consequences that follow and the responses required can be shocking and almost unbearable.
Case File 2. Thomas Richards. Travis Langley. Tax fraud, but it wasn't my fault. Thomas Richards. In the barber shop at the prison where the survivors have taken shelter, someone beheads Herschel Green's youngest daughters, Susie and Rachel. While Herschel, Rick, and others accuse some of the few remaining inmates, a different inmate, Thomas Richards, the self-proclaimed white-collar criminal who seems nerdy and oh so nice, beyond suspicion after having ingratiated himself by helping the women while they move into the otherwise vacant prison, finds Andrea in the laundry room and attempts to behead her. Andrea fights back. He chases her into the prison yard. There, Rick beats him so hard and for so long that he mangles both the killer's face and his own hand. The incident scars Andrea's face, breaks Rick's hand beyond repair, and inspires a dictatorial attitude in Rick as he decides that they have to hang Richards. When one misguided survivor, Patricia, tries to free Richards, believing him to be crazy, not evil, he attacks her too, and so the dead twin's older sister, Maggie, guns him down. Was Patricia right to assume he must be crazy, needing help instead of a hanging? Some crimes are so monstrous that the average person assumes that their perpetrators must be mentally ill, because no rational person could do such a thing. Many people wonder how any jury could have looked at Jeffrey Dahmer, who'd murdered, dismembered, and sometimes eaten 17 young men and older boys, and found him sane. Dahmer knew what he was doing, though. However bizarre his ideas, choices, and actions might have been at times, he knew he was killing people, and knew it was wrong. Insanity is a legal term, not a psychiatric diagnosis, and its definition can vary from state to state and nation to nation, depending on how the relevant legal standards are worded. The most common standard, the right or wrong test, deems a defendant insane only if, as a result of a mental disease or defect, the person either didn't know what he or she was doing or didn't know it was wrong. When Thomas Richards attacks Andrea, he is not trying to fight off some creature he has hallucinated. He knowingly tries to decapitate a living woman. Richards appears to be a serial killer, although not even his fellow inmates know the real reason for his incarceration. Had he been arrested as a serial killer, they'd have heard. A police officer's description at the start of a Walking Dead Season 1 video game indicates that he has been convicted for murdering and dismembering his own wife. Although Richard seems accustomed to his role as beheader of young women, killing the youngest girls first suggests that after months of confinement, he is starting out small. He may be experimenting with decapitation to test the way the world now works, because an intact brain means even a detached head can reanimate. Tempting as it may be to throw together a profile of a typical serial beheader or any other serial killer, no one follows a rulebook when becoming a monster. There is no standard. Compared with other murderers, expressive beheaders are more likely to kill relatives, or engage in cannibalism or necrophilia, although the majority do not. Compared with terrorists and executioners, whose violence is more instrumental, with extrinsic motivation, aimed at serving an ulterior purpose, serial beheaders' violence is more expressive, intrinsically motivated. They kill for the way it makes them feel. Thomas Richards meets every criterion for evil's dark tetrad. Psychopathic in both personality and actions, dangerously self-centered, deceitfully manipulative, and sadistically cruel. Yes, sadistic. He leaves decapitated girls to reanimate, just as Woodbury's governor, the man who cuts off the hand that Rick ruined punching Richards, does with his own victims. Furthermore, if Richards simply wants to kill Andrea, he could slit her throat before she knows what's happening, instead of flashing his knife and announcing what he plans to do. He toys with her until she escapes, and then his temper takes control. Insanity does not explain his actions because he is not insane. When he decides and prepares to kill, he realizes what he's doing. Subsequently losing control and recklessly running into the prison yard while shouting and wielding a knife, does not change that.
Life dies. In an apocalypse, a world dies. A new age also begins, but very few of those who survive from the previous era welcome the reign of the dead. The dead kill. The living kill. The elements kill. The world kills, not only by ending physical life, but by crushing the spirit. Buried beneath the rubble of grief, fatigue, stress, and far worse, what does it take to feel alive? What must a survivor do to keep humankind going and one's own humanity alive? Don't open. Dead inside. Part 3. Dying. 9. Walker or Biter? Group Identity in a Grave New World. Catherine Ramsland. Rick Grimes. We can all live together. There's enough room for all of us. Now you put down your weapons, walk through those gates, you're one of us. We let go of all of it, and nobody dies. The Governor. Kill 'em all. Group identity is a core component of The Walking Dead. Some groups welcome strangers, others shun them, and still others embrace them with evil intent. The Walking Dead provides a perfect forum for discussing the tenets of group behavior that psychologist Mussafer Sharif and his colleagues studied in 1954. They designed a reality-based experiment to examine in-group identity in periods of conflict and periods of cooperation. Parallels between their work and many of the situations depicted in The Walking Dead are so close, in fact, that the milieu itself could be framed as an experiment. What if protagonist Rick Grimes and his group discover that a researcher has placed them among flesh-eating creatures for science? With its extended conflicts and higher stakes, The Walking Dead builds on Sharif's discoveries, but supports a less optimistic conclusion. Rick understands the value of cooperation. Generally, he prefers to negotiate for a peaceful settlement, whether with a benign farmer such as Herschel Green, or with a tyrannical madman such as the governor. By the time he leaves the prison encampment, though, Rick has learned that success comes only when the other party is willing to meet him halfway. The secret lies in two interacting factors. One, having a superordinate goal that both groups want but cannot achieve without the other's help, and two, knowing that both groups possess and will act on this awareness. Sharif identified the first factor, but Rick learned the second one the hard way. Groups. Groups are basic social units consisting of interdependent individuals with emotional ties and clear social status and roles in relation to other members. Groups develop values and rules of behavior from which members absorb a sense of in-group identity that buffers them from out-group individuals. After the zombie outbreak, known among some as the Turn, countless people have become mindless flesh eaters, and the odds for survival favor groups over individuals. Overarching the franchise in every form, comics, TV, games, is the notion that only those who pool their strengths ultimately will find or create a safe place. After a group forms, it protects its own, the in-group, and tends to keep outsiders, the out-group, out. Part of this process is to identify threats. During the early days of post-outbreak awareness, individuals are in transition. It's like a game of musical chairs in which they're not quite certain which seat they'll get. Rick awakens from an unconscious state to a world transformed to chaos. He must deal with the unfathomable fact that shambling people all around want to eat him. He seeks others like himself. Groups form quickly in this grave new world. Sometimes they form among people already associated with one another, such as Herschel's family and the prison inmates. At other times, circumstance and location throw people together, as in the case of the roadside campers. Rick gets some of both. He first meets Morgan Jones and his son, who orient him to what it takes to survive in the midst of these walkers. Rick learns that walkers are attracted to noise. Their bite kills you, but then you come back as a walker. Hunger drives them, and killing them requires destroying their brains. This helps, but he needs to find his wife, Lori, and his son, Carl, and so he pushes on. He crosses paths with Glenn, and then, in the television version, Glenn's fellow campers, Andrea, T-Dog, and Merle. As they face off together against a walker herd, Rick proves his worth and gains in-group status. He travels with them to the camper's location and finds Lori and Carl, as well as his law enforcement partner, Shane. The campers form the Walking Dead's primary point-of-view group. They lose members but retain a core group. It is evident that hierarchies and roles must develop for the group to function effectively in a world its members barely comprehend. Rick emerges as a leader. Tentative bonds form during the early days as weaker members look to stronger ones, and all cling to the hope that the nightmare will end. As they take risks, run missions, release Merle, rescue Glenn, and protect one another, their associations strengthen. Nasty retorts fade as respect and appreciation grow. A group identity forms. No outsider can mess with any in-group member without consequences. Each member brings to the group whatever he or she can. In the city, Jackie provides knowledge as a city zoning officer when they hope to escape through the sewers. In the woods, Daryl Dixon uses his skills as a tracker. Some members will change a lot as they make choices for the group. Daryl is a prime example. After starting out as a redneck, ready to hurt anyone he doesn't like, he becomes a protector and even a leader. At first, its members view the group as temporary solace. Only as they realize that it might be all they will ever have do some adopt a new sense of themselves and their roles. Carol Peltier grows from a cowering, abused wife into a fierce and resourceful warrior. Dominant figures influence the group's core values. Rick's compassionate family seeks a safe haven. The paranoid governor makes preemptive strikes and creates strict rules for Woodbury. The cannibal Gareth dictates the dehumanizing values of Terminus. You're the butcher or you're the cattle. And the Monroes assign jobs in Alexandria. Personality issues recede in the face of collective effort and need. This is the first glimpse of how a goal that transcends differences, a superordinate goal, can inspire cooperation among adversaries. Information conformity and group identity. Absorbing group norms can be a subtle process. The social psychologist Musafer Sharif ran an experiment to learn how people conform in unclear situations. Because every survivor in The Walking Dead experiences a loss of clarity, all are vulnerable to group pressure. To study group influence on individual perception, Sharif projected a spot of light onto a wall in a dark room. From studies on perception, he knew that the autokinetic effect, a visual illusion, would make the stationary light appear to move. In the dark, people will estimate its movement in accordance with their mental norms. He sent individual participants into the room. Their task was to estimate how far the light moved. Estimates varied from 8 to 31 inches. Each participant then entered a room with two others. Sharif composed each group of two individuals who had had similar estimates, say 8 inches, and one whose estimate had diverged significantly, 25 inches. As they watched the light together, they stated their movement estimates aloud. Over numerous trials, the estimates tended toward agreement. Without discussion, each group naturally found its own norm. A week later, a more profound result occurred. When Sharif retested participants individually, he found that even if they once had diverged greatly from their group, they now replicated their group's estimates. Sharif believed that they had absorbed a group norm. Differing from conformity by pressure, this is known as informational conformity. To demonstrate its effect on the Walking Dead characters, let's call Rick Grimes a low estimator and Shane Walsh a high estimator. The others in the initial group looked to both as leaders until their differences put them at odds. The group absorbs Rick's reasoned approach rather than Shane's survival of the fittest idea. With each new situation that requires a difficult choice, the group coheres around Rick's stance. In unclear situations, most people look to others for definitive information. Into the Robber's Cave. To learn about in-group versus out-group behavior, Sharif attempted to create controlled conditions in which relatively equal groups could compete for limited resources. The research team set up those conditions in a Boy Scout camp at the 200-acre Robber's Cave State Park in Oklahoma. They sought to test the development of hierarchies and roles among strangers engaged in a series of choreographed tasks, as well as to learn about the nature of in-group identity. Over the course of 3 weeks, the experiment was to evolve through three stages. 1. In-group formation, involving activities that promoted group identification. 2. Friction phase, which would bring the groups into conflict. 3. Integration phase, which would encourage conflicting groups to cooperate. Convening. In phase 1, the team recruited 22 boys and randomly divided the volunteers into two groups while keeping the groups relatively balanced in skill and strength. All the participants were around 11 years old and had similar educational levels, above average IQs. None had experienced unusual stress or frustration in their homes. None had been a failure academically or socially. None had known any of the other research participants before the study, and neither group initially knew about the other. A bus took each group separately to cabins in different areas of the park. Counselors, researchers acting as participant observers, encouraged them to bond through enjoyable activities done together, such as swimming, a treasure hunt, and sports. The researchers kept records of the speed with which group identity was established. Leaders soon emerged, along with low-status members and rules for behavior. One forbade swearing, for example, whereas the other allowed more vulgarity. This is like Rick's group before Woodbury. Unaware of other groups, they work on doing what's necessary to survive. They meet and incorporate Herschel's family, lose a few members, and push on to find answers, or at least a home. The Walking Dead's in-group formation phase shows their bonding experiences, from entering dangerous terrain to talking quietly about their lives before the turn. Andrea finds a necklace for her sister Amy in an abandoned store, and Rick, whom she previously had cursed out, mutes his law enforcement instincts and supports her impulse to take it. The rules have changed, and their secret draws them into a friendship. At Robber's Cave, each group chose a name, the Eagles and the Rattlers. Each name became a badge of in-group identity. It helped establish to whom they were loyal. They even emblazoned flags with their group names. In The Walking Dead, the groups normally don't identify themselves with labels, but the name they use for those who have turned reflects their in-group identity. Glenn calls them geeks, but Rick, who heard the term walker from Morgan, influences a change that sticks. Woodbury residents call them biters, reflecting the governor's more defensive and aggressive temperament, and the stagnant hospital group uses rotters. At Robber's Cave, still in Phase 1, the boys asked the staff to arrange competitions, as if they wanted to prepare themselves for possible future competition. This further cemented in-group identity and group status. Similarly, in The Walking Dead, group members with skills teach others. For example, Shane teaches Andrea how to shoot. The governor takes this further by creating dangerous contests with biters to keep his warriors primed. Conflict. In Phase 2, the friction phase, the Eagles and the Rattlers became aware of each other. At first, they only caught glimpses. The Rattlers placed a flag on the baseball diamond to reinforce their claim to that territory. Each group asked the counselors to let them compete against the other to prove themselves. The researchers set up tournaments with prizes for different events. Only one group could claim the main trophy. The researchers also contrived certain situations, such as letting one group gain food items at the other's expense. As the competitions progressed, group identity became more cohesive, and this increased animosity toward the out-group. Threats and name-calling escalated to theft, raids, and property damage. Each group burned the other's flag. The Eagles won the trophy, but the Rattlers, claiming to have been cheated, stole the Eagles' lesser prizes. Reportedly, each group became so aggressive that the two groups had to be separated forcibly. Phase two ended early, yet the researchers considered it successful. They had produced conditions that inspired intergroup conflict. The Eagles and the Rattlers are like Rick's prison group versus the governor's group at Woodbury. When the governor learns about Rick's group, he wants to lay claim to all it has. In his mind, there are only winners and losers, and the winners should acquire the scarce resources. Insults fly back and forth, and both groups resort to violent forays. Each views the other as an enemy. There are no camp counselors in this world, but cooler heads in Rick's group prevail. After retrieving the group members they can save, the prison group hopes to coexist with Woodbury, but separately. The governor, however, must have it all. He encroaches, prepared to take the prison and its resources by force. He will kill everyone there if necessary. After the Rattlers and Eagles cooled off, the counselors asked each participant to describe his group. To a man, each favored his own group and vilified the other. They demonstrated a form of groupthink, something the political scholar Irving Janis would define years later as a maladaptive form of decision-making in which the members of a group tend to overly idealize their own position while exaggerating the evilness of bad groups. The group leader implies that only he has the right solution. Anyone who questions or argues with the leader in his theory is ostracized. When groupthink dominates, there is little chance for a successful outcome. When both groups do it, the odds for a disaster are almost insurmountable. The governor and Rick both view themselves as morally right. Each faults the other leader and his group for any negative consequences. The more the other side is done, the more the good group feels justified in defending itself and launching assaults. Cooperation. The final phase of the Robbers Cave experiment involved an attempt to integrate the two groups despite their sour feelings about each other. First, the researchers set up activities for the competing boys to get better acquainted, believing that mingling as equals would increase their tolerance. However, those activities had little effect. The boys refused to socialize. Mere contact proved insufficient to get them to like one another. The researchers switched to Plan B. They set up superordinate goals. In other words, they created situations in which both groups needed or wanted something, but could get it only by working together. The counselors took both groups to a new location and told them about vandalism that had damaged the drinking water system. To get water, they would have to repair the damage, and neither group could manage it alone. The boys were thirsty. They figured out what they needed to do. The researchers watched them work together to achieve this goal. Once it was accomplished, though, they reverted to their in-group preferences. The next task was to offer a movie, but the groups would have to pool their money to see it. Then they worked on a stalled food truck. With each new task, they softened toward each other. They started to mingle spontaneously. They ate dinner together for the first time. By the time the bus left the camp at the end of the 3 weeks, the groups had integrated with self-selected seating arrangements that did not follow group lines. The Rattlers even used their prize money from earlier competitions to buy a treat for the Eagles. As the governor threatens an imminent assault, Rick offers a way to cohabit in the prison, with everyone working the gardens and fighting off walkers for the greater good. Unfortunately, the governor operates on phase two thinking. Only one group can win, and his group is the most deserving. He cannot be persuaded. He gives Rick's group two options, leave or die. Nothing will compel him, a man who kills anyone outside his group without a second thought, to cooperate with Rick's inferior band. To the governor's mind, they are nothing but a threat that must be eradicated. Out of the cave. Despite its insights, there were limitations to Sharif's experiment. The groups were small, the participants did not represent any general populations, and the time period was too brief to study such complex dynamics thoroughly. The science journalist Maria Konnikova says, "As the stakes rise, as the diversity increases, as the group identification becomes based on something more than a random division into cabins, so too does the difficulty of unraveling the enmity increase." Sharif found that when a number of individuals who have no previous relationships interact, roles and status hierarchies form. Leaders and followers emerge, and group identities form around a set of values and rules. If they compete for resources with another group, they will form unfavorable stereotypes about the outgroup and keep them at a distance. However, differences can be overcome if conflicting groups see a benefit from working together toward a superordinate goal that neither can achieve alone. Back to the opening question, what if Rick's group discovered that a researcher had placed them among flesh-eating creatures for science? Besides being upset, they could have told us much more than Sharif and his colleagues did. Rick discovers similar principles with in-group versus out-group conflicts. Mere tolerance exercises would fail, as would high-minded appeals. However, a superordinate goal, such as having to pull together against a herd of walkers, stands a better chance. Even so, not everyone in the Robbers Cave experiment could drop the animosity and get along. Sharif paid little attention to them, but the seeds of people like the governor were among those boys who simply could not get along. Rick could not afford to ignore this lesson. Having a superordinate goal is a good strategy, but it works only when all conflicting groups are willing to cooperate to achieve it. The Walking Dead effectively illustrates Sharif's results, but also shows what's missing in his experiment.
10. Apocalyptic stress, causes and consequences of stress at the end of the world. William Blake Erickson and John Blancher. You don't know what it's like out there. You may think you do, but you don't. Rick Rhymes. It is not stress that kills us. It is our reaction to it. Endocrinologist Hans Selye. People like to complain about the stresses of everyday life. Homework, personal finances, and planning one's future are all normal stressors in day-to-day existence for most people. These stressors are puny, though, compared with those a zombie outbreak creates. In fact, psychological stress, such as that experienced by survivors of the zombie apocalypse, has transformative power socially, mentally, and physically. People change. Although some stressors are obviously unique to the zombie apocalypse, such as fearing that the approaching stranger may be dead and bitey, many are amped-up versions of those from daily experience. To those trying to survive in a chaotic world after a zombie outbreak, knowing what kinds of stressors they might encounter and how to deal with them is essential. The Walking Dead produces many examples of how struggling to survive affects people in the long term, and also how basic social and cognitive abilities suffer. Sources of stress. Even a normal person facing the horrors of a zombie plague has limits. Enough environmental stress potentially can turn the most moral, empathetic person into a killer, or transform the most brilliant strategist into a buffoon. Needless to say, the zombie apocalypse would be quite stressful for most people. But precisely what about it would be stressful, compared with pre-outbreak life? A dangerous world. In a world in which the dead walk and devour the living, an individual safety is paramount. People need to feel safe and secure, and they experience intense stress when this is jeopardized. The ubiquity of walkers around every corner and within every structure and lodging keeps mortality at the forefront of the mind. The bottom line is that reminders of death and one's inescapable mortality are unpleasant. Fear, anxiety, and stress follow the perception of a dangerous and unkind world. Intergroup competition. Perhaps more dangerous than zombies or other people. This becomes increasingly clear as The Walking Dead progresses. A long line of enemies pose significant threats to Rick and company. Limited resources, for example food, shelter, ammunition, create group competition and trigger kill or be killed survival instincts. Social isolation. The formation of small groups of survivors certainly results from a human need to affiliate with others. People want to belong because living in groups is mutually beneficial. However, survivors of the Walking Dead outbreak continually find themselves separated from others, loved ones, friends, and community members, through death or when fleeing mortal danger. Social isolation takes a psychological toll on people. Feeling alone increases anxiety and stress and hinders functioning. The katana-wielding Michonne, having been alone for some time, tells Rick that she sometimes talks to her dead boyfriend. Instability and control. Life is disordered and volatile for those struggling to survive in a dead-dominated world. Homes are lost, families are broken, and sustenance is hard to find. Repeated fluctuations between safety and danger, companionship and loneliness, and feast and famine put immense strain on people. Humans need stability and a sense of control to go about their daily lives with confidence. Rick and his band of survivors take refuge at a secluded farm, a secure prison, and a false sanctuary at Terminus, only to be run off. What follows is a sense of randomness, helplessness, and lack of personal control. Internal struggles and moral conflicts. Survival in this dark, chaotic, and dangerous world can require people to do bad things. Betrayal, deception, greedy behavior, and even murder. Martin, a member of Terminus Cannibals, verbalizes this to Tyrese before threatening Judith. You're a good guy. That's why you're gonna die today. However, the commission of sinful deeds conflicts with a basic need to see oneself as a good person, and therefore invoke an internal struggle. This happens time and time again throughout the series as characters face moral dilemmas and confront shame. For example, the priest Gabriel Stokes is tormented by memories of locking his church and ignoring his congregation's pleas while hordes of the dead devour them. Confronting internal demons associated with what one must do to survive invites psychological stress and discomfort. Ambiguous loss. Death in general is an obvious result of the zombie apocalypse. However, unlike other apocalypses, this is one in which the dead have taken over the world of the living, and death itself is an active agent against survivors. To individuals, the death of loved ones imposes a heavy cost on emotional well-being. From the very start, a survivor is faced with ambiguous loss by not knowing if loved ones have survived or if they are alive but psychologically distant. The zombie apocalypse yields a unique variety of this type of ambiguous loss, because the walkers are active and physically present, but mentally gone. Some compelling emotional moments in the franchise, from Morgan's struggle with killing his own wife, to Daryl's grief over the loss of Merle, arise because the people they loved are physically present, but no longer alive. Physical needs. Trying to get along with other people is not the only thing that comes under strain when resources are scarce. After all, scarcity is a problem only because the things that are scarce are necessary. Food, clean water, weapons, fuel, and even sleep are now precious. Above all, scarcity arouses uncertainty, and the risk of uncertainty can make decision-making skills go off the rails. For example, Andrea spends months surviving with Michonne. However, she decides to live what she believes will be a more familiar and comfortable life with the governor in Woodbury, despite warning signs. She thus abandons a high survival probability scenario in favor of a low survival probability scenario, merely because the perceived risk in the latter is lower. What does stress do? Deficits in physical and mental health. Stress has profound effects on a person's physical and mental well-being. For instance, heightened stress can trigger insomnia and restless sleep patterns, weaken the immune system, suppress or boost appetites, and cause headaches, tremors or shakes, shortness of breath, chest tightness, nausea, and fatigue. Psychological stress also can worsen existing conditions, referred to as psychosomatic diseases, such as stomach ulcers, eczema, plaque psoriasis, high blood pressure, and heart disease. Stress is a killer in waiting. Equally bad are the mental health consequences of stress. Some people are more vulnerable than others to the development of specific psychological disorders, such as schizophrenia and depression. There is a genetic component and an environmental stress component, and their combination determines mental illness outcomes. This is the central idea of the diathesis stress model. Throughout The Walking Dead, psychotic breaks and other symptoms of mental illness plague the characters after traumatic events. Rick experiences visual and auditory hallucinations in response to the death of his wife, Lori. Morgan falls into delusional madness after the death of his son and wife. Finally, Lizzie Samuels, a young orphaned girl at the prison, shows clear difficulty understanding reality. Unable to discern critical differences between walkers and living persons, she murders her younger sister with no remorse. Yet she is inconsolable after Carol kills a walker. Because major stress is more common in this new world, so too are the rates of mental illness among survivors. Disrupted cognition. Another consequence of increasing the number of stressors is an increase in cognitive load, which refers to the working memory capacity that a person has to devote to ongoing tasks. These tasks include many abilities most of us take for granted, such as learning, long-term memory retrieval, and communication. The greater the load on a person's working memory capacity, the greater the likelihood that she or he will make a mistake at an otherwise easy task. The result is almost always that performance suffers. Imagine a group of survivors now. Many have almost no survival skills or knowledge of how to live off the land. Learning how to do so can be its own challenge, but the added danger brought by the undead and other survivors makes learning and applying these skills prone to mistakes. Arousal and performance. Stress increases the level of arousal that a person feels. Normally, heightened arousal is necessary, getting people in the zone for a task. However, arousal has a curvilinear relationship with performance. As arousal increases, so does performance quality. However, at a certain point that varies among and within individuals, performance begins to decline because there is only so much a person can take. This effect manifests throughout the series, particularly after the group grows accustomed to the walker threat. A small group of walkers is easy enough to dispatch with knives and arrows. However, relentless waves become difficult to handle, because the constant, sustained high arousal eventually hurts performance. Even the best zombie killer will make rookie mistakes. Of course, the level of stress required to break varies from person to person, and depends on experience and prior knowledge. Series favorite Daryl Dixon is a survivalist, and his pre-outbreak transient lifestyle makes him adaptable to life after the apocalypse. Andrea's sister Amy, a college student easily overwhelmed by what has happened to the world, is less able to adapt and died early. Stress creates blind spots. Have you ever been frustrated when a heroic character in a zombie movie seems unstoppable until at an improbably inconvenient moment, a deader seems to sneak up on her seemingly without warning? You've just watched this character take on every challenge in her path, only to be cut down by a zombie red shirt. There is a good reason for this that is rooted in the Q utilization hypothesis. Briefly, the hypothesis refers to the fact that there are many observable cues in an environment. However, under high stress, a person focuses only on cues related to surviving. The hero sees a few high-resolution patches of immediate danger in a sea of blurry, unimportant things. Most of the time, this works out well. However, the hero is now very easy to sneak up on. So the next time you want to scream at the screenwriters for cheaply killing off a character, remember that the hero can pay attention to only so much before being overwhelmed or worn down. Coping with stress. Strategies for coping with stress widely vary, but all serve to make one feel better, at least in the moment. Some individuals in The Walking Dead deal with their stress directly through problem-solving, such as when Woodbury's resident scientist Milton Mamet attempts to conduct research. Often, though, people rely on rationalizations and avoidance-oriented strategies. As the series shows, some strategies are more advisable than others. Attentional avoidance. Many characters adopt a strategy of avoidance coping, focusing their attention away from the major problems they face. The best example may be the main character's settlement of the prison. Settling the prison allows the survivors to recapture something of pre-outbreak life. Rick puts down his gun and begins farming, and the children who come from Woodbury take classes in the prison library. Woodbury itself is an example of avoidance coping on a massive scale. An idyllic little downtown is walled off and powered, giving its inhabitants a life similar to the one they once had, with beer, electricity, community events, and sanitation. Although avoidance coping can help those suffering from stress, it also can produce undesirable byproducts. The quaint, bucolic life at the prison softens Rick's resolve. The citizens of Woodbury turn a blind eye to the governor's questionable ethics because their lives are easy. Eventually, both Woodbury and the prison meet their downfall as a result of the survivors' avoidance of very real dangers. Rationalization. When things look bleak, people often do their best to convince themselves that it isn't actually all that bad, and survivors of the outbreak are no different. This is, of course, helpful for alleviating stress and discomfort. For instance, feeling helpless through a lack of control is unpleasant, but people irrationally perceive that they have more control over outcomes than is possible. This may explain the sudden boost in Carl Grimes' arrogance after they leave the prison. Other times, people like Herschel cope by appealing to supernatural power, to explain events in a way that maintains a sense of order and meaning. People also rely on explanations that cast the self in a positive light. When people fail or do something immoral, they are likely to think it happened because that was the only option available. But when people succeed or do something honorable, they want it to be because of qualities inherent in them. Survivors of the Walker outbreak at times have to do terrible things to endure, as when Carol murders and burns sick members of the prison community to halt the spread of disease. She tells Rick that she had to do it. The circumstances demanded it. Learned helplessness. Rather than rationalizing away or avoiding stressors, sometimes people succumb to the belief that they are powerless and lack control over their lives. In such cases, people fall into a potentially harmful coping strategy called learned helplessness, in which they give up and stop trying to escape bad situations. Right after the outbreak, the survivors strive to overcome a bleak situation. But this pattern breaks down later for some who display characteristics of learned helplessness. For instance, many scenes throughout the series show the suicides of people who feel trapped and powerless. Most characters don't succumb to learned helplessness, though, perhaps because they have a resilient personality, an optimistic disposition, or social support from close others. Rick usually seems resilient, responding to most stressors as challenges. Herschel is optimistic, tending to see the glass as half full. Bob grows to see the glass as all full, and Maggie and Glenn have a strong supportive bond to carry them through stressful events. Stay vigilant and maintain control. Traumatic, life-changing stress inevitably rears its head in a world where the dead walk among and feed upon the living. Many of the old outlets for meeting physical and psychological needs no longer exist, and survivors must acquire them by themselves. Worse yet, the post-outbreak world almost makes these things difficult to attain by design. In the face of overwhelming odds, though, the people who live in this dangerous, strange world may flourish, as long as they can keep one eye around the next corner and the other down into their hearts. 11. It's the humans you have to worry about. Becoming a sociopath. Martin Lloyd. You're the butcher, or you're the cattle. Both Gareth and Mary. Residents of the Walking Dead universe find themselves beset by all manner of horrors. The most obvious are the reanimated, rotting corpses, constantly trying to tear human flesh from bone, turning each victim into a new walker. Despite the shocking presence of the hungry dead, the greatest tragedies visited upon Rick Grimes and the other heroes of the Walking Dead often come at the hands of their fellow humans. Whether it's the governor publicly decapitating Herschel and driving everyone from the prison, or subsequent cannibals nearly killing the entire group, the worst horrors come from living people. What kind of person could so callously bring such suffering to others? Who, for example, could lock a bound and unarmed Glenn in a room with a walker? Who could cut off a man's leg and then casually discuss its flavor with him? In psychology, the term for an individual who can easily do those things is a psychopath. Psychopaths generally are defined in terms of a lack of empathy, meaning they lack awareness of or concern for the emotions of others. It might be easier to calmly butcher a line of prisoners for food if you genuinely did not care how they felt on any level. Psychopaths also tend to excel at manipulating people and often look at others as nothing more than a meal ticket or a means of getting something. They are often aggressive and may engage in a wide variety of criminal behaviors. Professionals disagree about exactly what makes a psychopath. Some have proposed that psychopaths are utterly lacking in any emotion, but this has not been well supported. Psychopaths seem to have no problem experiencing anger and are not insensitive to pleasure and feelings of contentment. There is, however, one emotion that genuine psychopaths do appear to lack. They seem to be without fear. They do not get anxious, and they do not experience the same physical reactions to crisis, for example, sweating, shaking, racing heart, freezing up, as other people. A person with these characteristics may be familiar to some readers by another name, sociopath. Sociopathy is among the most poorly defined terms in psychology, largely because the definition has changed a number of times. The most useful way to define it is probably to think of a sociopath as looking and acting exactly like a psychopath. The difference is that psychopaths seem to be essentially born that way. They never develop any empathy. Sociopaths, in contrast, develop psychopathic characteristics in response to the events in their lives. Were various characters from The Walking Dead always without empathy and remorse, that is, psychopaths? Or did they develop those traits in response to their circumstances, that is, sociopaths? The primary question, however, is whether the various characters meet the diagnostic criteria for psychopathy. The psychopathy checklist. Most mental disorders are diagnosed by using the criteria set forth in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM. But to assess psychopathy, clinicians use the psychopathy checklist, revised, second edition, PCLR. This test consists of 20 items, with each one referencing a specific behavioral pattern or mental state one expects to see in a psychopath. Each item is scored on a 3-point scale in accordance with how well it describes an examinee. 0, not at all. 1, somewhat. 2, very well. Clinicians base their scores on interviews with the examinee and any other available information, usually medical and criminal records. In most settings, examinees who receive 30 or more of the possible 40 points are designated as psychopaths. PCLR items fit into two major categories called factors. Factor 1 items deal with the emotional aspects of psychopathy and the ways in which psychopaths tend to interact with others. Factor 2 items concern criminal behaviors and a psychopath's expected lifestyle. Factor 1 items: glibness or superficial charm, grandiose sense of self-worth, pathological lying, conning or manipulative, lack of remorse or guilt, callous or lack of empathy, emotionally shallow, failure to accept responsibility for one's own actions. Factor 2 items: poor behavioral controls, impulsivity, irresponsibility, need for stimulation or proneness to boredom, criminal versatility, lack of long-term goals, early behavioral problems, revocation of conditional